Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Embracing the Journey of Aging podcast with the SOME Center for Gerontological Excellence at the University of Iowa. I am your host for today. My name is Jen Jones, and I am the program coordinator for our Optimal Aging Initiative at the SOME Center. And I am joined today. I am super excited because not only do I get to see this person as a co-worker involved with the SOME Center, but I'm also just in awe of Kitty Buckwalter. So here's what we have to say about you.
All right.
All right, Dr. Kathleen Buckwalter. Actually, I was like, I didn't know you had a name besides Kitty. You are not only a community member here locally, but a professor emeritus from the College of Nursing. You are a member of our SOME Center leadership team, for which we are incredibly grateful. And as I said, better known to the universe is Kitty, right? Yep. Dr. Kathleen seemed so formal, and I thought, gosh, anybody that knows you knows how easy you are to talk to. So I'm so excited to have a conversation with you today. A lot of it will be about the work that you've done, the research that you have done, but also about how you got to that point. I kind of want to go back in the time machine, Kitty.
It's good for me to reminisce.
Okay, too. There you go. Yeah. Well, right, it's a good thing. So let's start with that. You, am I right, have been in the Iowa City area your whole life?
All my life.
I did not know you were
born
in Iowa City.
Born at University Hospitals.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've lived here ever since then. Yeah. Couple of times away visiting professorships.
Okay. At
Duke University School mm-hmm. of Nursing in 1991. And, I did a stint in the Navy during the Vietnam War. I was in San Diego and then spent most of my time on Guam before coming back here to graduate school. Pretty much located here. We did a sabbatical in Oxford, England, and in Bern, Switzerland, mm-hmm. For short periods of time. Hauled the family over there, which I just, you know, cellos and video games and stuff you could never do on an airline now. But those were great experiences, yeah. But we were always happy to come back to Iowa City.
So were your mom and dad Iowa,
yes.
Iowans also
yes.
then? Okay. Mm-hmm. Were your parents involved with the University of Iowa?
They were not.
Okay.
Part of the reason that I stayed on, although I did have some other opportunities, job opportunities, was I'm an only child. Only child, nurse, Catholic, who's not going to care for their aging parents. And so
we won't unpack all of that today. But,
they were both born in this area and died here.
Yeah. So what led you out of high school to the University of Iowa? And did you go straight to the College of Nursing? And, like, what was the system when you were going through school? Was it still the School of Nursing, or was it College of Nursing by then?
It was a College of Nursing.
It was a College of Nursing,
yes.
Okay.
And I did not start at the University of Iowa in the College of Nursing.
Okay.
I started as a music major.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I still love music, but my freshman year, I enjoyed playing in the symphony, and I played in the chamber orchestra, took lessons, classes in theory and that sort of thing. But I did not like the solitary nature mm-hmm. of being in a practice cubicle for hours every day, which is essential if you're
right.
going to
right.
Be in performance. And I found that my personality was really, I wanted to be more with people.
Mm-hmm.
And so my sophomore year, I applied to the College of Nursing, but I was a year behind
right.
everybody else. And at that time, nurses were really considered second-class academics.
In the sense that
the basic science courses were, there was chemistry for nurses and physiology for nurses, which were dumbed down, if you will, from the classes that, let's say, pre-med
sure.
students were taking in the same
right.
Basic sciences. But since I was not starting with my class, I ended up taking the same courses as the very hard-charging medical students. But I made it through the prerequisites and eventually got into nursing. And it seems like, I think, an odd
transition. It seems like a complete 180, yes. Music, 180 from music. What was your instrument? Was it cello?
No, violin.
It was violin. Okay,
but,
yes.
But none of my courses my whole freshman year transferred.
Mattered.
Yeah. Maybe one elective or something like that, but really I had to start from scratch. But I always say nursing is the family business. Mm-hmm. On my father's side, I'm one of seven graduates of the University of Iowa College of Nursing.
That's awesome.
Starting with my great aunt Geneva in 1925.
Wow, when it was the School of Nursing. Yes,
yes,
and everybody
right.
was in West Lawn.
And my aunt Vivian was the first when it was a college. It was a 5-year undergraduate program that she went through here. Cousins, children of my cousins.
Yeah.
So there are seven of us, and I think we take a lot of pride in the University of Iowa College of Nursing. The men in the family work at the post office.
Oh, that's so funny. like, we all figured. Like, but what was the string that pulled you? From music, no pun intended on the string that pulled you. But what was it, that family history that you were like, oh, I see everybody, you know, Aunt Genevieve was a nurse, so maybe that's where I'm supposed to be? Or was it just random?
I think there were multiple factors. That was part of it, family history, and I admired and respected what my relatives had done and were doing. I worked at Oak Knoll as a CNA in high school and also in college. I actually did special duty for an older gentleman who had had a stroke, and so when my classes were over, like at 3:30 in the afternoon from 4 to 7, I worked with him, and I really enjoyed that. So I had some nursing, not professional nursing, but I had exposure to nursing environments, and I loved it. I loved being a CNA, which is and caring for people.
Right.
It's very really gratifying. Still is extremely rewarding.
And older adults, because that plays into such a huge part of your whole. Your professional career is this concept of caring for the older adult and the research that you have done. And, you know, we talk about with the SOMI Center how our goal is to promote optimal aging and quality of life. And I will say, you know, my personal story is that my mom has had 4 strokes and is in a nursing home. Yeah. And I don't know what we would do without our CNAs.
Yeah.
You know, the
yeah,
care
the
that they get for, oh my gosh,
care.
It just, and so... not recognized for what they do on a daily basis, and we are so eternally grateful that they love and care for her. So,
And there's another factor I have to say. Remember, I'm like 19, and my best friend from high school had gone away to a school in Minnesota but decided to come back. Her dad was the county coroner, and so we thought, we'll go into nursing. She's also the one that said, let's get out of Iowa City. We'll join the Navy because the Vietnam War was raging.
Yes.
So we joined the Navy together. They paid for a small stipend and our books, and then we owed them 3 years of service. But a lot of it was not thoughtful career planning or anything. It's really been a career by fiat, if you will. but did have the family history. Went in with my friend, and so a lot of different factors. And then I just really did not do well as an undergraduate. West Lawn was where the College of Nursing was at the time.
Yes,
and I failed Foundations of Nursing. I dropped the soap in the sink and sterile hand washing technique.
All the things we're going to learn about Kitty today.
making an occupied bed. Madeline, my friend, was my partner
the
in this.
The occupied
I made the bed, but with her on top of it, which is much more difficult, but that's not the way you're supposed to make a bed. The worst was sterile dressing techniques, which I also failed. Now, these are fundamentals of
kind
nursing.
Of key components. So it's so funny to me that these stories are like yesterday to you. Like forefront of your mind that this was how your career was starting.
But I use them in my own teaching when I would have students who were discouraged.
Sure.
Say, well, yeah. I don't think I can. I want to be a nurse, but I don't think I got what it takes. And I would tell them the stories. I will say that I had some undergraduate instructors, Carolyn Kroll and Marjorie Moore, come to mind, who encouraged me. So we were supposed to write an essay on why we went into nursing, and I didn't write an essay. I made a collage. And I thought, well, this will never be accepted, so that'll be another
F. You'll 0 for 5,
but
right? Yeah.
She found that to be creative, and the message that some of these instructors gave me, which I desperately needed at the time, was there's a place for people like you in nursing. Don't be discouraged.
Yeah.
And I found the undergraduate curriculum to be so rigid, and I chafed at it. So I dropped out of nursing and I went into occupational therapy because it still had some of the same rewards and working with people. But the program was disaccredited the semester I transferred into it. So I went back to nursing. And kind of suffered through our medical model curriculum till I got to my senior year. And my senior year was like the aha moment. Oh. I took psych and public health, and I thought, this is it.
You found it.
This is what I love. This is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And I was really passionate about it. And I told you recently, I also took a bunch of independent studies. This is the way I got my interest in things that were non-nursing.
Yes.
And some were very health-oriented, but like the one of the independent studies I did my senior year was at the Institute of Gerontology with Woodrow Morris, and it was on this 1970, brand new concept called dementia. If you can imagine forecasting a career as an undergraduate student, but I just absolutely loved it.
Wow.
And so creating opportunities for independent studies to when I could explore things that were of interest to me beyond the nursing curriculum.
Yeah.
I took lessons in Italian language. We had no language requirement in nursing, but I love opera, and I wanted to be able to read some librettos. So I was trying to do things that were a little bit against the grain, but really helped me get through the nursing courses until I arrived at my senior year. It's a little late to have the aha moment, but that was...
But there's an aha moment time that's different for everyone. So I love that you're sharing this story because I do think there are a lot of students who will listen to this who maybe are in that freshman, sophomore, junior, even that senior year, and they're like, when is it going to happen?
Yeah.
You know, they know deep down somewhere I'm in the right track, but they just haven't had that course where you go, this is it.
Here's where
this
I fit.
Is it. Yeah, this is where I fit. And we all
and what I want to do.
I'm in my mid-50s, and I think I finally founded the Somme Center. So it takes some of us longer than others. But what an enriching way to live. All these independent studies that bring this outside experience and maybe something that seems so otherworldly to nursing, but you run into patients from all over, especially here in Iowa City, you know, at the university. So it's, you know, your love of music or your love of a language maybe speaks to someone for whom you're caring. And that is where that transition of, oh my gosh, you're the nurse providing that incredible care to someone makes all the difference in the way they have that outcome, that health outcome.
And, you know, things do come full circle. And the opera, it did in many respects because I was early on involved in looking at music therapy as an intervention, actually for pain originally, and found that people who liked opera, that I could relate to them and play the music that was distracting. We were using music as a distraction for pain.
Yep.
So in ways that you would never or I would have never thought about. Same thing with clinical and research interests. My master's thesis here, and so after I got out of the Navy, I came back on the GI Bill and got my master's degree in psychiatric nursing. It was an MA, not an MSN, and it was, we had the medical model curriculum, so psych, mental health, nursing, was the area I chose. I just loved it. I just loved it. But then I went right on from getting my master's degree, but I started in a three-semester non-thesis master's program because I wanted to be a clinician.
Okay.
And
not an academic researcher. No, that was not. You were going to be
wanted to be was an independent psychotherapist. That was my goal, and it was just starting now that nurses could do that sort of thing,
right.
And actually get reimbursed for that.
Yes.
But I didn't. I needed a job while I was in graduate school, and the only one left, because I came back from the Navy kind of like 2 weeks before graduate school started, was as a research assistant for Ada Jaycox, who had a federal grant. This was before NINR, but it was the National Center for Nursing Research, and it was called the Pain Project. It was on pain.
Oh, wow.
And so I just thought, oh, God, research. Ugh.
Right.
I don't want to do that, but it's a core course, so I do. But I fell in love with research as her research assistant. And she opened up so many opportunities for me to give presentations, to write book chapters as a graduate student, and to see the value of clinical research in terms of patient outcomes and patient care, that my three-semester plan turned into 2.5 years.
Oh, my gosh.
And she guided me to say, you really need to go on and get a PhD, which was just starting. So this was programs were just starting in the country. There wasn't one here till 1989 at Iowa. But, for example, as her research assistant, she would hold conferences here, and I was the gopher. I'd pick people up at the airport and bring coffee and do stuff like that. But she always introduced me.
You were networking. Before we even knew the word networking, you were
networking.
Unbeknownst
to me,
she
was setting me up. And one of the people she set me up with to drive back to the airport was Helen Grace, who was the dean of the University of Illinois at Chicago at the Med Center College of Nursing, which had one of 10 PhD programs at the time. And so she and Ada had talked and conspired to say, maybe you should think about going to Chicago and getting a PhD. So I did my master's from 74 to 76 here in psych nursing.
Okay.
And then 76 to 80, commuted
by
Greyhound bus to Chicago for 4 years.
And you had kids?
I had two kids. My first two kids were born during the doctoral program, so I've always been particularly sensitive to my students who were, work-life balance and family issues.
Right.
And plus the commuting, and I couldn't afford out-of-state tuition and an apartment in Chicago. So the University of Illinois was on a quarter system at the time, and there were 10 people in my class and 10 weeks in the quarter. So every week I lived with a different classmate, which had the added benefit, not just financial, but of socialization, being a commuting student.
Yeah.
But I knew my classmates better than anybody else because I lived with them every semester or every quarter, and which was absolutely wonderful because I was well integrated into my class, even though I would leave at 2 a.m. on it would be Monday morning by that time. Get into Chicago by 8 on the Greyhound bus.
Oh, my gosh.
Go to class.
And on the Greyhound bus. In case you missed that, she wasn't driving. She was getting on the Greyhound bus.
We had one
through weather, I was going to say. And the roads were not, it's not like it was I-80 as we know it.
And
so
there were some characters on that bus. The bus went from New York to California. And some wild experiences there where I was trying to study during the night.
And you're like, by the way, I think we can use you as a resource.
We had one old rattle trap car that would barely make it from our house on Benton Street to the hospital. And my husband was a resident at the time.
Okay.
And so there's no way I could have driven into Chicago. So took the Greyhound wow. bus. Then I'd catch the train to the medical campus mm-hmm. and go to school. And then I'd go home from Monday to Thursday with a different classmate every week. And then Thursday night at 8, I would leave on the bus and come back at 2. And then I worked nights at Psych Hospital.
Oh, my gosh,
on Friday,
oh
Saturday,
gosh.
And then Sunday would leave.
Okay, so leave obstacles. Kitty knows how to get over
yeah.
obstacles. You
yeah.
just, you know, sometimes when you find what you love, you just figure out how to do it. You really do. You know how to put your head down.
Yes.
So this was your PhD.
It was.
What was your official, like, what is your PhD? Is it? Psych mental health. What
yes,
is
psych mental health.
Health?
It was
okay.
actually designing, implementing, and evaluating a discharge planning program in a psych ward for depressed patients.
Okay. So, you know, I'm thinking about, oh my gosh, the way we look at mental health now and how we continually say we want to have better conversations about it. But here you were, 1980, where a lot of people did not want to talk about mental health in outside of the clinical realm.
Right.
You know, in society, we weren't talking about mental health. I don't, you know, I think about people I probably knew who had depression, but we didn't know the word depression outside of the clinical world. How was that integrated into your clinical practice? And when did you start to see that kind of edging out of clinical practice into society?
Well, it really didn't in those early years.
Well, and that's what I'm wondering,
I was lucky.
Right?
The dean, Helen Graves at Illinois, was a psych nurse herself.
Okay.
And so I had a lot of support and guidance in terms of what I wanted to do for my dissertation.
Sure.
And I took an independent study with her where I would read recommended mm-hmm. Books or journal articles and just have a discussion with the dean
right.
every
wow.
week, which was really, I learned about theoretical frameworks and things that weren't part of my PhD curriculum, but it really solidified my love for this mm-hmm. area. Also, I did clinical practice. And it was called ISPI, the Illinois State Psychiatric Institute, which was
wow.
right on the campus. And
yes.
it was
wow.
the really old world asylum.
Eye-opening.
So
I
such
oh
an eye-opener.
Gosh.
And it really said, we can do better. We have to do better.
Right.
And so there was a lot of joy in working with this, joy and sadness in working
yeah.
with this population.
Right.
And wanting to be in on changing that.
So how did those changes come about?
Well,
I mean, obviously
I struggled
it was slow.
With some of it, I would
yeah.
tell you. I came out of my only practice right out of undergraduate was in the Navy during the Vietnam War.
Okay.
And I spent most of it on Guam. We were extraordinarily autonomous.
Sure.
One reason being there was no telephone system on the island.
Mm-hmm.
So if I... As a nurse, and I worked nights so I could scuba dive by day.
It was a little different than other locations.
I wasn't so career
yes.
focused at the time. But scuba diving was great on Guam, by the way.
Yes.
So I would never think of paging one of the physicians for a simple order because they were all he's
of
at
course.
The time,
yes.
would have to drive to like the... Hilton, there were a lot of Japanese honeymoon hotels and Hilton
okay.
Hotel, and
okay.
phone in to the hospital for the order. So we had standing orders like you wouldn't believe.
Oh, just ready to go, sure.
And,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of respect from
right.
and very collaborative practice. It was almost like being
wow.
an advanced practice nurse without the
wow.
credentials, but just the circumstances.
Sure.
We got AeriVacs from Vietnam coming in. We had a mesh pad on the back
yeah.
of the hospital. You didn't have time to pussyfoot around it.
Wow.
So... I come back, I start graduate school, I start working nights at Psych Hospital, 2 days, and a patient I was caring for spiked a temp and I ordered blood gases. And then another one was constipated, and I ordered milk of magnesia, which is, you know, you can buy it at Walgreens. And I got called before a medical tribunal for practicing medicine without a license.
Gosh,
big
Kitty.
Slap on the wrist. I was able to explain to them that my only practice reference had been as a Navy nurse during the Vietnam War. And if I had called a physician to get an order for milk of magnesia, I would have been run out of town.
Given
what was going on.
Perspective.
And so I didn't get, like, fired, but I got a big verbal reprimand. The other huge difference, and maybe you've read that book by Kristen Hanna, The Women.
Oh, I love Kristen Hanna. Oh, my gosh.
We didn't have the
fabulous author.
We had Aravax, but we had people who could live past the front lines who were too sick or injured to make it back to the States.
Oh,
that's
gosh.
Who we got. So it wasn't the level of trauma and everything that is documented in that book. But it was busy.
Right.
We also had typhoons. And since we were one of the big concrete structures on the island, all of, like, the pregnant women from the surrounding Marianas Islands would come in.
Right.
And we weren't allowed to leave if we were in the nursing staff within 48 hours of the eye of a typhoon. We just stayed in there and
hunkered down, basically. Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
So very different practice model. And that was...
But that was your whole experience.
It
was. Your, all your perspective.
And it was a great learning experience.
Right.
So here, you know, I had a BSN from the University of Iowa. I thought I was pretty,
you knew your stuff.
Pretty hot stuff. My first day as a nurse on Guam, I had a poisonous stonefish bite.
We don't have that in Iowa.
a child dying of tetanus from one of the outer islands, which we were responsible from a World War II trust territory convention for caring for.
Yeah.
I had seen pictures in a textbook.
Right.
I'd never actually seen a child dying of tetanus.
Yeah.
And then they said to me, one of the local swimmers has got the bends, which is from diving too deep.
It's an air pressure.
But it also affects the heart. There's something called mediastinal drift.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to go sit in the decompression chamber. And it did not take long for me to become humbled after thinking I knew what I was doing and having no idea how to ride a decompression chamber or what to do with somebody who's had a poisonous stonefish bite. You know, it was humbling. It was also a terrific experience in organization, dealing with Aravax coming in, dealing culturally with the Chamorro people, the Guamanians, who had a belief that if you were present when the soul of the person left the body and went to heaven, that they celebrated before burial 7 nights, and they wanted you were an honored guest
to
be there. Well, I worked nights, and so sometimes I could go.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, the delicacy was fruit bat at these funerals.
You're like, sorry, I might have to miss that one. Wow.
But if I couldn't make it because of my work schedule, the families would bring in things because it was important for me to be involved in these rituals. And so the cultural components, and whenever I had a weekend off, I would go on these missions to Palau and Kapangi Morangi and Eastern and Western Carolinas, the outer islands, where we would do assessments, which started with DLouse and DInfest, and then begin. And so it was an abrupt change from practicing in Iowa.
But the ultimate experience in community health.
Absolutely.
Which I think about what you said earlier, where you got that experience with psychology and community health. This was the ultimate, which I don't think we think about here, maybe in Iowa, especially Iowa City, where we have the specialist and everything. But you get out maybe even into some of our rural areas in Iowa, or where we do have other cultures who have come in to work. The way we need to approach healthcare does need to be a little more of that community health, public health concept. And it's funny to me that you were dealing with these things late 60s, early 70s, mid 70s, and we're still talking about these things, and it's 2024.
But also honoring their traditions and
respecting
and the importance of the family.
Absolutely.
So those were important lessons early on.
So fast forwarding, so now you've had this experience, you're a PhD, and you've discovered you love research. What happened in Kitty's life with the research? Because there was something called PLST that became incredibly important.
That actually wasn't the first.
Right.
So I came back for graduate school from 1976 to 1980, and then I joined the faculty of the College of Nursing. I was the first PhD in nursing on the faculty here. And I thought, well, again, a little hubris here. I'm going to just do great things. And I was assigned to teach Introduction to Health to 175 pre-nursing freshmen. And I think it was, like for their essays, trying to teach them what a primary source was, because they'd often referenced like Mademoiselle magazine and
that wasn't research.
I commuted to Chicago for 4 years in order to teach.
Right, they're quoting this, Mademoiselle, which was a magazine back in the day. So,
but then the college got a grant to move the master's program to Des Moines to expand it, and I was tapped to teach the research methods course there. Now, there were two professors, Gloria Bielichek and Hope Solomons, teaching 7 students at Iowa. I had 13 students by myself driving to Des Moines.
Yeah.
But these were such committed, these were nurses who worked all day, 7 to 3:30. We had class from 4 to 7, and they came, and some of it was deer in the headlights, like, because I also taught the statistics component. But I think every one of them went on and got their master's from the University of Iowa. Some of them became faculty.
Right.
A lot of them were like from the VA in Knoxville and the VA in the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown.
Right.
And went on to leadership positions. And if they didn't conduct research there, they fostered the conduct of research in their own institution. So it was what could have been a bad thing, because I had a baby, and I would take him when I drive to the Drake campus, which is where we held classes, to a sorority house, and they'd babysit with him from 4 until 7, and when I was done teaching. And then I would, if the weather was bad or something, I would stay over with one of my students, but usually drive home.
Yeah.
So that was an important lesson in research by teaching it. And then I also, Jerry Felton came in as the dean then, and she was bound and determined to take us from that second class academic status. She said, our faculty will have PhDs.
Oh, I love it.
And we will have coursework on a par with everybody else, and we will make the same promotion and tenure expectations as all other faculty. So at that time, we had tenured assistant professors without PhDs on the faculty.
Sure.
And this was not their fault. It was the maturation of our profession.
Right.
And so it was perfect to be in on the groundwork. Mm-hmm. I was just coming back to a place that said, we're going to move forward. Eventually, in 1989, we started our own doctoral program, which was a great source of that. But I started a research project with my former student colleagues at the Knoxville VA, which was called Increasing Communication Ability with Patients with Aphasia. Most of them had stroke.
Okay.
And you say, well, why? What's a psych nurse doing with that? But I was really interested, and I observed from my clinical practice there that these patients were isolated. Their chairs were always up against the wall.
Pushed
they weren't engaged.
Away.
They
yes.
weren't participating in activities.
Yes.
And I was interested in the emotional consequences of their lack of being able to communicate, mm-hmm. And the social isolation mm-hmm. and lack of engagement had for them, especially anxiety and depression.
Oh, depression, yeah.
So I partnered with the wonderful speech-language pathologist team at Knoxville and wrote a grant. It was my first large grant, that like over $200,000, from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Yes.
And the setup at Knoxville at the time was ideal for a controlled experimental study. They had two identical building 101 A and B.
Oh, perfect.
And they were, the patient populations were very similar. Mm-hmm. The mm-hmm. staffing was very similar. And so I had 101 A was my experimental unit and 101 B was my control unit. And that was my first real big externally funded study. And the message I got from Dean Felton, I should have called her Jerry. Dean Felton was, okay, here's what we need from you.
We need
external funding.
Yeah.
And we need, in addition to grants, we need publications.
Wow.
Which was not the norm or expectation. And I heard the message.
Right.
It was good advice.
Yeah. You were leading the way, because that is what's expected now, and that is part of the reason we have, you know, number four in the nation with our College of Nursing now, that those things are expected. So you were the change.
Well,
a part of that change, right.
So how I got into gerontology was through the research route.
Okay.
And I was at a lawn party of a faculty member, Joanne McCluskey, who had a lovely brick house on Melrose Avenue. And it was the 100th anniversary of the house, and it was having some lemonade with Jay Semmel, who was then one of the directors of sponsored programs.
Okay.
And I said to him, just in conversation at this party, Jay, the dean says that I need to get some grants. So if something comes across your desk that you think I might be interested, let me know. I mean, this is career by fiat.
Yeah.
Within 2 weeks comes this campus envelope with a yellow sticky and still with a smiley face, which we're just coming out about the
funny
time, from Jay saying, apply for a career development award in geriatric mental health from the National Institutes of Mental Health. And I looked at the criteria that was offered to psychiatrists mm-hmm. and to psychiatric nurses only. And you had to have a master's degree in psychiatric nursing, which I had.
Right.
And the psychiatrist had to have completed a residency. And so I thought, well, I'll write this. It's a K-1, a career development award.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
No, they weren't any at the time. And so I checked myself into the Alexis Inn, which is this kind of skaggy hotel, because I had to get away from my children to be able to write this grant over the weekend. And I had two by that time under the age of two. And it was not easy to concentrate at home. So I wrote the Career Development Award. I gave it to Dean Felton to look at. And she's a good editor. She made a lot of suggestions. And then I engaged, we had a nurse physiologist who is a nun. I'm trying to think of her name now. I can't remember. She was wonderful. She was PhD prepared, and she taught the physiology courses. And Liz Burns was her name. And Woodrow Morris, from my experience.
Yes.
And then Tom Walz, who was at the School of Social Work, who was a gerontologist as well.
Wow.
And I made them my, like, internal advisory committee and wrote this grant about, I need to learn gerontology. So the first year of my career development award, we'll be taking coursework, and I'll be taking courses with Dr. Walls at the School of Social Work and elsewhere. And then I'm going to develop grant sites.
Yeah.
And one was the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown, Iowa. Another was the VA, where I started. Mm-hmm. And the third was the Abbey Center for Community Mental Health, which is where I wrote a grant for the Elderly Outreach Project, the Mental Health of the Rural Elderly Outreach Project. All three of those kind of pilot years during my career development award turned into major external funding awards. One from the Administration on Aging, one from NIMH, and let me think where the other one was. NINR.
Yeah.
And so it that was the pivotal point in my career was this Career Development Award, this K Award. Not only was I socialized into what happens at the NIH and the grant mechanisms.
That's the National Institute for Health, if anyone is listening doesn't know those acronyms.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I was so naive when I started out and submitted this K Award. Liz Burns came around to my office. I was working late at night, and she, I had put her on my grant. She said, "Whatever happened to that?" And I said, "Well, I guess I didn't get it because I haven't heard anything." I didn't know it took 9 months.
To hear back.
Yeah, I had no knowledge of the mechanisms, and we had nobody on our faculty at that time who was really.
Were we in internet yet?
I don't remember. It was probably mid to late
80s.
I wrote it on a yellow pad.
So it wasn't that instant feedback that we're so accustomed to, right? Yeah, now.
But she said, "Well, did you get a pink postcard?" And that's how they would notify you of receipt. And I said, "Yes, I've got it in a drawer here." And she said, "Call the number." And because she
had experience. Yes,
her area was fetal alcohol syndrome, what happened to neurologically in fetal alcohol syndrome. She's a great researcher. And so I did, and I got the deputy director of the National Institute of Mental Health answered the phone. And he said to me, "Well, don't jingle the coins in your pocket." I can remember this conversation. "But your priority score," this is before percentile, so that's how
okay.
"Your priority score is XYZ. I didn't know what a priority
score
was.
What does it even mean?
I didn't know what pay lines were. And it goes to council in 2 weeks. And I didn't know what council was. I didn't know there was a two-step mechanism that you had to get through,
the system, the process.
The system. They had to have the grant and approved, and then council, would they fund it? I was also very, very pregnant at that time with my third child, teaching summer school, a research methods course, and I got the grant. I found out in July. She was born in September during the first meeting of my group in Washington, D.C., and I thought, this will just confirm everybody's fears about funding a woman and funding a nurse. So what does she do?
Wow.
She misses the meeting because she's having a baby.
Having a baby. Right. Yeah. Well, that's it. She's out.
But that was the turning point, the exposure to other investigators, the collaboration, not only with my nurse colleagues there who are from all over the country, but also with the Gero psychiatrist, who was a really a changing point. And I came back, and part of the expectation for having had this award is that you will start things related to geriatric mental health back at your own institution. So I developed a course and a doctoral program.
And I love what I'm hearing here, too. You know, I said when we introduced Kitty that she sits on our SOMA leadership team, which is interdisciplinary because aging doesn't care what you do.
That's
it doesn't
care
your background, what your degrees are in, if you even have a degree.
In fact, it's an asset to get those different perspectives.
Right, it is. It makes us better in what we're doing. And I'm hearing, like, you were starting to pull these people together from these different backgrounds, these interdisciplinary backgrounds, to talk about all the different factors, socioeconomic, whatever it might be, that impact the way we age, but our mental health. And you hear that now, and I think, you know, you have this kind of exploded post-COVID that, we need to look at our social determinants of health. And it does. Yeah. We know that it's holistic.
We just didn't call it that.
I know all of this time, but so interesting to me. It's so interesting to me. You're stumbling your way forward into the successful career and doing all of these things that were really, when you look back on it, they were firsts of their, you know, especially for us here at the University of Iowa.
And I've been... speaking of reminiscence, dealing with that lately because it's the 50th anniversary of the Journal of Gerontological Nursing, which I was the second editor of from 1997 to 2011.
Wow.
And I went back and looked at some of those issues that I had edited.
Right.
And we were already starting with things like health equity. We didn't call it
We
called it, you know, we need to pay attention to ethnicity.
Right.
And social determinants of health. But again, we looked at environments and that sort of thing. Just beginning, but laying a foundation for what is now coming to fruition 20-some years later.
Are we doing better?
We're doing better.
Are we
we're not
like,
there
make
yet.
Make me feel good,
doing...
Kitty. Like, make me feel good about all of the work that you've done.
Remember that old saying, we've come a long way, baby?
We've come a long way. We've still got a long way to go.
Exactly right.
We are doing better.
Yeah.
And I feel like we're having, and I hope we're having healthier conversations about things like mental health, about aging. You know, I was having this conversation yesterday with someone, and we're the same age, and I said, you know, when my grandma was our age, she was old. Like, she went, didn't drive. Grandpa took she and my Aunt Marguerite to get their hair done, and they sat, and they lived in this bubble where they were old. And I look at what can be accomplished now and the way we live optimally, whatever that means for you. And you don't stop. You're like the Duracell bunny. Because not only you had this amazing career from which you've retired, but boy, do I use quotes around that, because you don't stop. You're still engaged and
active.
Well,
there's a lot you can do. I formally retired in 2011.
Yeah, everybody would laugh at you.
But I'm still engaged.
Yes.
And that's, I think, you know, the advice I would give younger people, find something that you're passionate about that will sustain you. And then you can find ways. It may not be still, and thank God I don't have to write grants anymore, but I still love to edit.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I love working with people both in Jarrow and outside of Jarrow with, you know, about the complex care in the community group.
Yes.
And
I
work with doctoral students getting their, both here but elsewhere around the country, in getting their publications out of their dissertations, which is an essential step. So there are things I still have some competencies for, and I've told everybody I work with, look, if you see me like using the third edition of APA or something awful like that, call me on it, and I'll know I'm starting to...
That'll be my sign.
Yeah,
right?
Time to gracefully retire. But I still find so many things interesting, and it's really a joy to see, just a wonderful joy to see my former students. I'm going, actually, to Ohio State this weekend because one of my former postdocs, Harvard postdoc, is the dean of the College of Nursing there, and she's invited me for the Ohio State-Iowa football game. But also to be a visiting professor for a day there.
Yeah.
So it just people have done so well, and I loved teaching my students. In fact, when I retired from here and Oklahoma offered me an opportunity to teach their Jarrow doctoral students, I took it because I still, it's a source of satisfaction.
Sure.
It's kind of a selfish
You're still impacting people's lives and their ability to have a really amazing career. And, you know, something I talk about when I'm out with community doing community engagement, we do talk about research, education, and practice a lot at the Somme Center because we're with the College of Nursing and the University of Iowa. These are the things that we do. Those things, the research you've done, will impact the way I age. You know, sometimes we don't think about what that research is that's happening and how it will impact us down the line or our kids. And it will help us. It really does. And so it's hard to sometimes to place when you're not from that academic background, placing yourself into that universe and, okay, how is this going to touch me? Well, it touches you every day if you go to the doctor.
It does. And I realized that, you know, I thought when I was caregiving for my parents, I thought, I'm supposed to know this stuff. I'm telling other people what to do. And it's still a struggle when it's personal.
When it's personal. The emotional connection is tough. And I also love, too, what you were talking about just a few seconds ago, the reach of the University of Iowa College of Nursing. We have placed students into these leadership roles in so many universities across
all over all over the world.
Over the world.
Exactly.
And you've got to be a part of their careers. You get to still be part of their careers. And that's incredible.
And it's very rewarding to see all the good things they're doing.
Two questions I wanted to ask you. What do you think of the world of gerontology, the field of gerontology today?
Well, I think I'm
and I know that's a wide open question.
An optimist.
Sure.
I think there's not enough, but increasing recognition of the continuum. So,
yes.
You know, we need to start thinking about our health.
Yes.
And aging.
Mm-hmm.
A lot
earlier.
Good things for ourselves.
Right. Yeah.
We're discovering the importance of engagement and mm-hmm. social mm-hmm. contact, and the
right.
other side of the coin, the adverse consequences of social isolation.
Yeah.
Iowa City is a wonderful community to live in. The senior college, I take at least one course,
yes.
I've taught a couple of them every semester. Aging with vitality.
Yes.
And all of those things I think are protective.
Yes.
Cognitively.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful being in a community where there are so many opportunities.
Yeah.
Like that.
And you are also, I will say, not only are you probably like the best liaison for the College of Nursing at the University of Iowa, but you are also an incredibly active community member. You are volunteering. You sit on boards. You are putting yourself as a resident into these places where you can also impact the way people of all ages live. I want to give you a shout out on that. If you want to name some of those, you're welcome to, but
well,
I know I run into you at other locations or I meet other people and they're like, oh, well, do you know Kitty? And we're like, everyone knows Kitty.
Well,
and I think that again comes back to that. It's engagement. It's staying connected. It's being challenged. You know, so-and-so has an issue, and how do we get together?
Yeah.
We pull all of our resources together to solve that and make life better for people.
Well, I think there's a lot of luck. So I didn't have a planned career, but I always relied on a quotation by Pasteur, chance favors the prepared mind. So I feel like my undergraduate and graduate education here at the University of Iowa gave me the curiosity and interest and fundamental mm-hmm. education to be able to try new things.
Yes.
And, you know, I had never been an administrator, but then I became the associate professor for health sciences for 7 years. And that was a clear departure. And then coming back after 7 years to a faculty role and have to restart the whole grant process and everything. But it was all good. And the other thing I would say is, so the timing, starting my career when I did
in the
early 70s, when gerontology and the concept of dementia and caregiving was exploding, when the National Center for Nursing Research became an institute, when NIA and NIMH, which previously had not funded nurses, started embracing them into their portfolio.
Yes.
I mean, I was so lucky just to be in on the groundwork of that and to, because of the Career Development Award, made those connections with other disciplines and other institutes besides nursing. But the other thing was having that clinical background from my days as a Navy nurse. And boy, you worked. You know, you'd report for duty, and if labor and delivery was busy, you delivered babies. If the OR was busy, you scrubbed.
Oh my gosh.
So I had a real sense of clinical mastery so that when I would teach research methods to clinicians who were like, wow, why do I need to know this stuff?
It matters.
And they would say, well, you don't know how busy we are. and we don't have time for research. And I'd say, let me tell you about reporting to work at a hospital with 122 beds and your census is 212.
Oh,
I know what busy is.
Right.
I've lived it. I appreciate what your circumstances
are.
So let's work together to find a way that we can make your practice evidence-based.
Yes.
So,
and we don't do anything now that isn't evidence-based.
I know. But I did a stint, you know, as associate director of the Office of Nursing Research, but I was physically located at the hospital.
Yeah.
Tony Church Brimer was there.
Yes.
And it was a collaborative. It was wonderful. I loved working at UIHC.
Yeah.
The nurses there were full of good ideas. And so were so bright. And when we started our doctoral program, it was a synergy
yeah.
of their getting the preparation to do the really good clinical research
yeah.
that continues to this day. And then saying our practice has to be.
Yes.
And developing these evidence-based protocols
yes.
With us.
What a change in the career of nursing you have experienced,
yes, yes.
you know.
Yeah.
I feel like we could do a part two with you. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, my
thank
pleasure.
Thank you for
I'm sorry
sharing.
Sorry I talked
your
ear off.
No, this is what it's about. It's so fun to be able to share community partners and researchers and all of the good people that we have met at the Somme Center and just giving you the opportunity to share those stories. You, before the podcast started, before we started recording, we were talking about that sense of history and how important it is. Sometimes you don't know where you're going if you don't know where you've been.
Yeah.
And we
but
talk about
that
history.
Also nursing in the context of social change.
Yes.
And part of it was I
yeah.
lived through women's consciousness
yes.
raising
oh
as a college
yeah.
student. And,
yeah.
you know, we would still stand up when a physician entered the room and
wow.
wearing
yes.
the pointed white hats and
yes and your skirts and your white yes
yeah,
yeah.
white hose and,
yes.
and that sort of thing.
different times but
we survived it and
yes.
developed a nursing identity
yes
and I can remember going around. I was Dean Feltman asked me to talk to other leaders who would vote at graduate
right.
school about should we have a PhD program in nursing. And the prevailing thought at the time was, why would a nurse need a PhD?
Why?
And
oh
I don't
gosh.
Think that
yeah.
anybody would.
Right. Nobody would even bat an eye. Of course
I know.
We need that now.
And that hasn't been
yeah.
that long ago. That was 1989.
Right.
So we've come a long way
yes, we have
in
come
a relatively
long.
short period of time. And I feel blessed to have been a part of that and a witness to it.
Yeah. So we're going to leave you with that optimism that we have come a long way. We have really done, and a lot of that here at the College of Nursing is thanks to
absolutely.
You. Appreciate it. So thank you for joining us today on Embracing the Journey of Aging. If you would like to hear more from Kitty, stay tuned. I think we'll have a part two down the road, but you can find all of our information on our website. You can search for us on all your social media platforms. We would love to contact contact from you and chat with you about how you are aging optimally. And thank you so much for joining us. Take care.